I'm Angela Wiley, and can you hear me? Can you hear me if I'm not there? No? Okay. No big deal. Yeah, really not a big deal. I can stand here. I am Angela Wiley, and I'm so happy to be here with you this morning. This place has really become my home. I was an immigrant to Champaign-Urbana. I came back in 1993. Seems like forever ago, but the community's been so welcoming. It's just been a wonderful place to be able to be. I will need that. Yes. And there we go. Perfect. So I'm going to start out by saying election 2016, wow. Have you been hearing about it? Just a little bit, yeah. Lots of excitement, lots of rhetoric, lots of conversation. Right about now, I suspect our pastors are feeling very nervous that I'm leading off with a political reference. I'm not heading any deeper down that rabbit hole, really, I promise, only to draw our attention to what is perhaps one of the most contentious and prevalent issues in this election season. Immigration is currently a hot topic, but immigration is not new. In fact, I'd wager that among our New Covenant family here, all of us have some history of immigration, some more recent than others. We'll hear a few voices.
Hi, my name is Anna Ilanova, and my mother and I immigrated here from Russia in 2006.
Hi, my name is Lori Kaufman. My great-grandfather, Christian Kaufman, came over from Switzerland in 1883.
Hi, I'm Bill Marshall. My grandfather on my father's side, he came over from Italy, actually in 1905 on Ellis Island, from Naples. On my mother's side, a great grandfather, William Solberg, arrived in the U.S. in 1852 from then Posen, Prussia.
Hello, my name's Mark Friedman, and my family immigrated from England in 1963.
Hello, my name is Gail Ferguson, and I came to the U.S. in 1997 as an international student, after which my parents emigrated from Jamaica to Canada.
I'm sure we could have many, many other examples. Thank you all for sharing about your family's stories very briefly. I'm not going to stand up here and deny folks that I have some convictions on this matter. I was well trained by some excellent psychologists who taught me that I should acknowledge my biases right up front. So I will do this. But first, I need to get it out on the table that this issue is not crystal clear with easy answers, as much as I might like to think that in my everyday life. The immigration debate is a debate because there are important and real tensions among decent people who are trying to follow Jesus. So some folks are concerned about obeying the laws that exist and creating and enforcing responsible policy. And indeed, we can find some biblical support for this. So Kai, how do I make this work? Do I just press the, here we go. Do I aim it at something? This isn't good. If you will show me how to do that. It's on.
Press this, and you should be able to just. control?
You should. If not, just tell me. It seems stuck on 13.1. Okay. Rich, will you hit it one more time for me? And we'll just do it that way. Indeed, we can find biblical support for the fact that we really do need to obey the laws that exist and create and enforce responsible policy. Romans 13:1 tells us, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities exist and have been established by God. So some of the concern is framed as taking care of our own, and who doesn't agree with that? We really do need to take care of our own. There are also some who emphasize concern for compassion, social justice, and the open arms of hospitality. And indeed, we can find some biblical support for that as well. So in Isaiah 58:10, it says, feed the hungry, help those in trouble, then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness around you shall be as bright as day. So the thing is, like many other important issues that divide us, it's a recipe for stalemate to frame this one as a struggle between polar opposites, mutually exclusive sides. As is the case for many complicated issues, this one involves an abundance of nuance. So now my own personal threads. Is just one example. My ancestor, Thomas Wiley, immigrated from Ulster, Ireland to South Carolina in 1762. In my current family, my brother is married to Susanna, an immigrant from El Salvador. My only niece is the child of an immigrant. My husband, Bill, who came forward, is a grandchild of immigrants from Italy and what is now Poland. I work with immigrants and refugees every day at the university and in the community, and I am an advocate. I believe that God has called me to this work. And all of that said, though, I do recognize the complexity of the issue, and I have been praying a lot in the last few weeks that God would lead me in speaking about it in a way that is fair and not only the outcome of my own personal biases. So, of course, I went to the great oracle of Wikipedia. Right, to get some numbers to begin this conversation. So nearly 14 million immigrants legally came to the United States between 2000 and 2010. 66% of those were admitted on the basis of existing family ties. 13% came for their employment skill, and only 17% for humanitarian reasons. The Pew Charitable Trust provides some information about immigrants and refugees who are here without documentation. You can imagine that's a little bit more difficult to kind of get our hands around those kinds of figures. But the Pew Charitable Trust tells us that in the latest figures, there are about 11 million, a little over, which is about a little less than 4% of our total population. So these figures have been pretty stable for the last half dozen years, regardless of what we hear on the media. Illinois is one of the six top destinations for immigrants without legal documentation. And this figure was interesting to me. About 7% of our students, K through 12, had at least one unauthorized immigrant parent in 2012. Did you get that? 7% of our students, K through 12. Undocumented immigrants have no real possibilities for legal entry into the U.S. in most cases, given the restrictive limitations on green cards. So low-skilled workers in and of themselves, without a relative here to help them, are not eligible for immigrant visas. There are a number of labels that we could use for undocumented immigrants. We could talk about aliens. I hate that, but that's a common phrase. We could talk about unauthorized. I'd like to back up for a minute, given that so many of us have an immigration history here, that when the first great European influx came to this continent, we did not call ourselves immigrants. We called ourselves settlers. And I'm guessing that those already living here might have had a few choice labels for us, some of which probably had the flavor of unauthorized. So that said, I'm going to use the word undocumented here to refer to immigrants who are here without legally accepted documents. I'm not going to make a big difference between immigrants and refugees. I'm going to use the word immigrants to include refugees, although I think we all understand that refugees are driven from their home country by circumstances such as war or political aims. And so that I don't have to keep repeating that, I just want to get that out. I've been reading Soren and Hwang's book called Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, and it has informed this teaching. And it is available on the resource table, and I encourage you to take a look at it if you're interested in more in-depth analysis and some very concrete strategies. There are also some resource sheets on that very back table that Caroline very nicely made available for us, so I encourage you to take a look at those too. Okay, so biblical examples of immigrants and refugees. So the Hebrew word ger is typically translated as someone not native to a local area, often without family or resources. That word is used 92 times in the Old Testament, often because God's people found themselves to be immigrants or refugees, sojourners or strangers. And many of these references, these examples, provide examples to us of how God used displacement to achieve a larger purpose, his good. In Genesis 11, Abram, later known as Abraham, immigrated from Ur to Haran and then to Egypt before settling in Canaan. Like many modern immigrants, Abram left his home to pursue the promise of a better life, this kind of stepping off the safety of dry land or out of a boat, as Renee taught a week or so ago, takes courage and faith. Give me the next slide, please. Abram may have been a natural rambler. As it turns out, some geneticists recently claimed to have isolated a genetic profile common to immigrants. You know, I have to get a little researchy stuff in here, right? The scientists say that they have located a gene that's partly responsible for risky novelty-seeking behaviors. And when they looked at the remains, the genetic profiles of some of the earliest migrants, the ones that left the African savannas and started humanity's journey to colonize the world, they found a high percentage of this shared gene. And when they compared that to the remains of those who remained behind, they had a much lower percentage of that gene. Abraham undoubtedly passed on this immigrant gene to his offspring, who were numbered as God promised him, like the stars. In another famous example from Hebrew scriptures, Joseph can be described as a particular kind of involuntary immigrant because he was forcibly expelled from his homeland by his scheming brothers who sold him into slavery. Next slide, please. Oh, you're there. Not the next one. Leave it there. Good. In Genesis chapter 37, we are told that in Joseph's case, forced immigration was actually a better alternative than what was first proposed. Next. When Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they recognized him in the distance. You remember that coat, right, of many colors? As he approached, they made plans to kill him. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain by killing our brother? We'd have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to those Ishmaelite traders. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. Next slide. The story turns out to have a pretty cool twist, the kind that we all dream of when we're wronged, right? We want our tormentors to have to eat some crow. And Joseph's family ends up having to go to Egypt with their bowls in their hands, pretty much literally. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." Next slide. And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God." So our involuntary immigrant, Joseph, turns out to have had the hand of God strongly upon him. Just like many other immigrants, Joseph changed the world around him. He made it, in fact, a better place. Lots of contemporary examples. People like Madeleine Albright, Mikhail Baryshnikov, Dave Matthews, Yo-Yo Ma, Albert Einstein, lots of these people. But Joseph outdid all of them. He actually saved not only his undeserving family, but also all of his people. I don't know about you, but I don't want to let his brothers off the hook all that quickly. I mean, they did, after all, sell him. But to borrow something that Ron has taught me and retaught me when I frequently forget, God lets nothing go to waste. And in Joseph's case, the heartache of being driven from his home was not wasted. God used ashes to make something seriously beautiful. Never fear, though, if you're the type who likes a little revenge, and you know who doesn't, right? The evil is repaid to an extent. In fact, many generations later, too, while the Israelites lived in Egypt as foreigners and refugees for some time to escape the famine, the Egyptians finally started to resent them for using up resources, sound familiar, and promptly enslaved them. So there are long roots in the ancient world to what has become an all too familiar story. Immigrants often arrive in a new place eager to work. They're sometimes deceived and mistreated, and promises are broken. The story of God's people continues with Moses finally leading them to escape Egypt and become refugees once again, wandering in the wilderness. There are many other examples of when God's people, either as individuals or en masse, fled oppression and found themselves homeless. And I couldn't resist this. In the words of Tennessee Williams' Blanche DuBois, they often had to depend on the kindness of strangers. You can go and now say that you have heard that reference in a message from the pulpit. There are also many instances of strangers coming into Israel, and there was a long history, because of necessity really, of welcoming strangers. Apparently, there weren't a lot of hotels and cracker barrels in the ancient world. Abraham and Sarah extended hospitality to strangers, and they were infinitely blessed by the encounter, as the three travelers who came to their home turned out to be God's messengers. Ruth was an immigrant who showed both remarkable kindness to her Jewish mother-in-law, and she benefited from the hospitality of Boaz, whom she later married, and I would end up, he benefited quite a bit from that little kindness that he showed. It's a good thing she wasn't deported, because this immigrant later became a great-grandmother of Jesus. Next slide, please. Jesus himself, with Mary and Joseph, was for a time a refugee, fleeing Herod and his murderous political aims, we're told in Matthew 2:14. But in a larger sense, Jesus might have been the penultimate immigrant. He left his perfect place with God to live in a strange world of very, very broken humans. In all of these cases and many more, immigrants provided rich blessings to those who welcomed them. The New Testament gives us example after example of the imperfect nature of the disciples and the early church. Next slide, please. Jesus must have really scratched his head at the strange world he had entered. Like the Israelites before them, the early Christians were scattered and persecuted. For example, Acts 8:1 tells us that on that day, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. But as in the Old Testament, the migration often ended better than it started. The early Christians often used their contact with new people to share the good news and to bring them to join the faith community. Those who accepted the early scattered believers benefited greatly by their contact with the Christian strangers in their communities. Turn again to Acts 8. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. For with shrieks, impure spirits came out of many, and many who were paralyzed or lame were healed, and so there was great joy. In fact, there was a sense among many in the early church that they were all exiles and aliens in this world, waiting for their true home in the world to come. Hebrews 11:13 tells us all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting they were foreigners and strangers on the earth. So my point is that God has often used migration for his purposes, and that those who came into contact and welcomed immigrants were blessed greatly by that contact. So next slide, what guidance does the Bible give us for how to treat immigrants? Next slide. There are abundant examples. In terms of the rule of law, in Leviticus 19, we're told that when a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as native-born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Then Exodus 12:49, the same law applies to the native-born and the foreigner residing among you. Immigrants are often categorized with other vulnerable groups who are close to God's heart, the orphans, the widows, and the poor. Next slide. Deuteronomy 10:18 tells us, he defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. Again, that reminder. And then in Zechariah 7:10, do not oppress the widow or the follower or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Given that immigrants are special and close to God's heart, we are told clearly to make provisions for them. I'd like to note that these are not framed as recommendations, right? These are not framed as a do it if you can, if you feel like it, if you want to. Rather, these are commands. That is the language of imperative, right? It is a command that we are to do this. The most repeated command in the Hebrew Scriptures concerns worshiping the one true God. And the second is some version of welcome the stranger, love your neighbor. The Hebrew writers clearly guide us to make provisions for immigrants. Next slide. Deuteronomy 24:19 says, when you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So that was about the sheaf. The passage goes on to talk about same thing with your olives and your grapes. The New Testament authors are also not remiss on this matter. They frequently reminded the early believers to love your neighbor, especially your vulnerable neighbor. For example, Hebrews 13:2 says that strangers may be angels, so treat them well. Clearly, the writer of Hebrews remembered what had happened to Abraham and Sarah. Jesus takes it even a step further, as he often does, when he inserts himself in the picture. Welcoming the stranger is the same as welcoming Jesus. I think this is a really big deal, so much so that I'd like to look at that passage more carefully. Next slide. Matthew 25:34. Then the king will say to those on his right, my father has blessed you. Come and receive the kingdom that was prepared for you before the world was created. When I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. When I was naked, you gave me clothes to wear. When I was sick, you took care of me. And when I was in jail, you visited me. Then the ones who please the Lord will ask, next slide, please, when did we give you something to eat or drink? When did we welcome you as a stranger or give you clothes to wear or visit you while you were sick and in jail? And the king will answer, whenever you did it for any of my people, no matter how unimportant they seemed, you did it for me. And then what about those who turned away the stranger? Next slide, please, Rich. Then the king will say to those on his left, get away from me. You are under God's curse. Go into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. When I was hungry, but you did not give me anything to eat, and I was thirsty, but you did not give me anything to drink. I was a stranger, but you did not welcome me, and I was naked, but you didn't give me any clothes to wear. I was sick and in jail, but you did not take care of me. Then the people will ask, next slide, Lord, when did we fail to help you? When you were hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick and in jail? And the king will say to them, whenever you failed to help any of my people, no matter how unimportant they seemed, you failed to do it for me. Then Jesus said, those people will be punished forever, but the ones who pleased God will have eternal life. I spent some time on this passage because I think there are many things we could say about it, and many who are better qualified than me to talk about the minutiae of interpretation. But what I take from it is very clearly that God cares about the vulnerable, including immigrants, and he charges us, again, not recommends to us, but charges us, that we have a responsibility to provide a welcome and care and love and hospitality to those people. And that's a good thing, because we are frequently reminded in the writings of the early church that those of us not from the tribe of Israel, we are immigrants. And immigrants are us. Next slide, Rich. Ephesians 2:12. At that time, you did not know about Christ. You were foreigners to the people of Israel. You had no part in the promises that God made to them. You were living in this world without hope and without God. But Christ offered his life's blood as a sacrifice and brought you near to God. I would say that Jesus undertook some pretty radical immigration reform in order to bring us into the family of God, to naturalize us. Next slide. Ephesians 2:14 says, Christ has made peace between Jews and Gentiles, and he has united us by breaking down the wall of hatred that separated us. Christ gave his own body. Christ gave his own body to destroy the law of Moses with all its rules and commands. He even brought Jews and Gentiles together as though we were only one person. He has united us in peace. On the cross, Christ did away with our hatred for each other. He also made peace between us and God by uniting Jews and Gentiles in one body. I'm sorry that we haven't lived up to that, right? He certainly did make it possible that we would no longer have hatred for one another, but I think we've gone a bit astray at times from that possibility. At any rate, Jesus joined natives and immigrants into one big reconciled family. Maybe not always deliriously happy, just like any other real family, but certainly a family. So, here we are. Those of us who received grace on such a cosmic scale in being granted citizenship into the family of God. What would happen if we could bring ourselves, even just those of us in the Christian community, to extend grace, not on a cosmic, but on a smaller scale, socially and politically, to our modern immigrant and refugee sisters and brothers? What if it is more than just the right thing to do? What if following the commands laid out for God's people yields rich blessings unavailable by any other means? It is easy to know in our minds in our intellects what the Bible says we should do. But how do we, in our modern context, achieve this? Next slide. We could spend a long time on this. I'm just going to hit a few highlights, and I recommend that you take a look at some of the resources and books in the back for more really wonderful ideas on what the Christian community can do. I believe that we are commanded to see and form relationships with our immigrant and refugee neighbors. Often immigrants are invisible, or if visible, they're often misrepresented. We must see our immigrant and refugee neighbors and get to know them, form relationships with them. And our neighbors may not be next door. In answer to the question, who is my neighbor? Jesus gave the familiar parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. He ends the relationship like this. Next slide. Then Jesus asked, which one of these three people was the real neighbor to the man who was beaten up by the robbers? And the teacher answered, the one who showed mercy. And Jesus said, go and do the same. Jesus illustrates here that our neighbor may not look like us, may not have the same theological bent as us. They may be troublesome. We may not even like them or feel all that charitable about them. But I guess what I'm trying to argue is I really see the Bible telling us that we don't have a choice. We are to do the same in showing love to our neighbors, particularly our vulnerable neighbors. We can fully embrace the spirit of this mandate to love and show mercy really only when we begin intimately knowing and building personal relationships with our vulnerable neighbors. The psychologist Mary Piper argues that relationships are deadly to stereotypes. And one wonderful way to get to know others is to partner with them to solve problems and to learn from them about their strengths and their cultures. Yes, I said learn from them. In my experience, I always get more than I get. I always get more than I give. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. When I'm working with immigrant and refugee communities. Another thing we can do is we can pray. So prayer is the foundation of a relationship with God in many ways. And I desire for prayer to be my first step before jumping into anything feet first or head first, as I'm prone to do. And it doesn't always happen as much as I'd like it to, I confess, but I am asking God to be patient and continue working with me on this area. When I read people like Henry Nouwen, I'm so inspired, and he says, it is compassionate prayer that calls for compassionate action. And once we have built those relationships and really gotten to know our immigrant neighbors, we can lift their pain and trauma to God. We can pray for fair and compassionate policies that reflect God's justice. And we can also pray for our leaders. 1 Timothy 2 says, pray for kings and others in power so that we may live quiet and peaceful lives as we worship and honor God. And one last reference to election 2:16. I think lots and lots of prayer is in order. And we should not forget to pray for the sending communities and the situations that lead immigrants and refugees to leave their homes and loved ones. We can also give, because as with any community suffering disparities and multiple challenges, immigrants and refugees often have very pressing needs, many of which can be addressed at least in the short term, by targeted resources. James 2:15 says, if you know someone who doesn't have any clothes or food, you shouldn't just say, hey, I hope everything goes well for you, buddy. I hope you're warm and you have plenty to eat. What good is it to say this unless you do something to help? Next slide, we can advocate. Rather than seeing the church as an entity separate from the world around us, there is a long tradition of Christians advocating for social justice. Proverbs 31:8-9 says, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves and for the rights of those who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly, and defend the rights of the poor and the needy. So yes, we are commanded to obey the laws of the land. I'll remark, though, that if Christians had taken this as a decontextualized, hard and fast truth, slavery might still exist in this country because those involved in the early Underground Railroad would never have stepped out of line. So it's a complex issue. Next slide. We might best see ourselves as charged to support our leaders by helping to educate them and support them to live up to their mandate to deliver God's justice. And as my undergrad advisor, who was a Quaker, would say, speak truth to authority and speak it loudly. It's not very Quaker of her, but she did say that. Clearly, the problems that drive immigration and make refugees are deep and wide. Poverty, war, injustice. These problems are the really intractable kind that are unlikely to be sorted out in any of our lifetimes, as much as I grieve that. But again, I return to the lessons that I have learned and relearned here at New Covenant. God's justice is real. And I trust that it will be part of the unfolding of God's story. So, meanwhile, back in 2016, completely open borders doesn't seem like a very feasible idea, does it? We probably need some kind of administrative monitoring for safety and so on. And we must take care of our own without question. There are deep injustices and wounds that many of us have here with no recent immigration history. God's mandate to love and care for our neighbor includes those who have been here for generations and the offspring of those who were brought here against their will generations ago, as well as those who were brought or arrived more recently. May a spirit of generosity and mercy emerge to serve as the basis for building real relationships, lasting relationships, and extending God's radical hospitality to those who are close to God's heart, the poor, the downtrodden, and yes, the immigrant. As we go to the communion tables, next slide, please. May we remember that we are part of the family of God by grace. And may God reveal to us how we can welcome our newest neighbors and be blessed by extending to them the grace that has been so richly and freely extended to us. Feel free to go to the communion tables that are around the outside of the sanctuary.